I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Donald Trump said on Wednesday that he would see nothing wrong in accepting damaging information on a U.S. political opponent if a foreign government offered it to his re-election campaign. In an interview with ABC's George Stephanopoulos, Mr. Trump said he would not necessarily call the FBI if a foreign power offered him information on an opponent.
It's not an interference. They have information. I think I'd take it. If I thought there was something wrong, I'd go maybe to the FBI if I thought there was something wrong. But when somebody comes up with oppo research, right, they come up with oppo research, oh, let's call the FBI. The FBI doesn't have enough agents to take care of it.
Mr. Trump said that he disagreed with FBI Director Christopher Wray, who told Congress last month that political campaigns should contact the agency about any suspicious communications from a foreign government. Mr. Trump compared damaging information on an opponent supplied by a foreign government to opposition research conducted by all political campaigns. A House committee has voted to hold Attorney General William Barr and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross in contempt of Congress. We get more from AP correspondent Ben Thomas.
We have 24 yeas and 15 noes.
With that, the House Oversight Committee sent a measure to the full House asking that Attorney General William Barr and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross be held in contempt of Congress
for defying duly authorized subpoenas
for documents related to the decision to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census. Democrats fear the question will reduce participation in immigrant-heavy communities and undercount minority voters. The White House asserted executive privilege on the matter earlier in the day, saying the administration has engaged in good-faith efforts to satisfy the committee's oversight needs after turning over more than 17,000 pages of documents. Ben Thomas, Washington.
And you can find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. President Trump said Wednesday that he would send 1,000 more U.S. service members to Poland as part of his broadening security and economic alliance. AP Sagar Magani reports from the White House.
The president's been praising Poland for meeting NATO commitments by boosting its defense spending. At a joint news conference with his Polish counterpart, he announced American forces will move there from elsewhere in Europe.
About 1,000 American troops.
And that the Polish government will pay for supporting them. He's also touting Poland's purchase of more than 30 F-35 Joint Strike Fighters, with a single jet flying over the White House today to mark the sale. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Hong Kong authorities were shutting government offices in the city's financial district for the rest of the week after a day of violence over an extradition bill that would send people to mainland China for trial. Early Thursday, just a handful of protesters remained milling about as widespread cleanup around the city's legislature took place. Police fired rubber bullets, tear gas, and pepper spray in a series of skirmishes Wednesday to clear demonstrators from the city's legislature. It was some of the worst violence in Hong Kong since Britain handed it back to Chinese rule in 1997. The Hong Kong Hospital Authority said 72 people had been hospitalized by 10 p.m. Wednesday. Police in the Dominican Republic say more people than first thought were involved in the shooting of former Boston Red Sox star David Ortiz. The AP's Ed Donahue.
Five people have been detained. Chief Prosecutor Jean-Alaine Rodriguez says the alleged shooter has been identified as Rolfi Ferrari, a.k.a. Sandy. Witnesses say the shooting at a Santo Domingo bar was carried out by two men on a motorcycle and two other groups of people in cars. Police say the coordinator of the attack was offered about $7,800 to carry out the shooting, and the alleged coordinator was among the suspects in custody. Rodriguez did not talk about a motive. Meantime, David Ortiz's wife says the man known as Big Poppy is in guarded condition at a Boston hospital. I'm Ed Donahue.
A former Stanford University sailing coach avoided prison Wednesday and the first sentencing to result from the U.S. college admission scandal. After admitting he took bribes to help children of wealthy parents gain admission to the school, U.S. District Judge in Boston sentenced John Vandermeer to 6 months of home confinement. Prosecutors wanted him to serve 13 months of jail. He is the first person sentenced in the scandal that involved millions of dollars in bribes paid to college coaches at prestigious colleges to get wealthy students enrolled. More at VOANews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawi's former vice president accuses Electoral Commission chair of helping the re-election of President Mutharika.
Obviously, if the chair of the Electoral Commission resigns, it will be a tacit admission of guilt. So it is basically what you may call a hardball game.
Rafik Hajat is the executive director of the Institute for Policy Interaction in Malawi. Gambia's government takes over the assets of former President Yahya Jammeh. Two more cases of Ebola have been reported in Uganda, and Sudan's military and opposition are set to resume talks on forming a transitional government.
Negotiations on an interim government are set to resume between Sudan's protest leaders and the ruling Transitional Military Council. What is not clear, however, is which side will have ultimate control of the proposed government.
That's reported now by Muhadi in Khartoum. And Rwanda's parliament passes a law banning single-use plastic products in the country. Those stories and Samson O'Malley's special FIFA Women's World Cup sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In Malawi, former Vice President Saulos Chilima has accused Electoral Commission Chairperson Justice Jean Ansah of directly influencing the results of the May 21st election to re-elect President Peter Mutharika. On Wednesday, a letter written by Mr. Chilima calling for Justice Ansah's resignation was leaked to the media. In it, Mr. Chilima accuses her of telling Election Commission staff that she would be grateful if they help ensure the re-election of President Mutharika. All attempts to get Mr. Chilima's party officials to speak on the record were unsuccessful. Election Commission spokesman Sangwani Mwafulira said in a text message that matters arising from the election were currently before the court and that it is only prudent to abide by the court rule of sub judice to avoid being in contempt. Rafik Hajat is executive director of the Institute for Policy Interaction.
Malawi at the moment is quite split. There are those who support the president and the election because, of course, they're partisan. And the 62% who did not vote for him are applauding the letter.
Who leaked the letter? Because the information I'm getting is that this is a leaked letter.
Well, this letter is being circulated throughout social media. And basically, everybody is aware of it. And it's we don't know who's leaked it, but I think it's been basically not leaked, but it's been distributed for general consumption.
One of the allegations made in the letter, the former vice president tells the Elections Commission chair, quote, "You told members of the commission that you would be grateful if they help you ensure that Professor Mutharika gets re-elected. You specifically mentioned that you did not want Reverend Shekwera to be elected because his running mate is a Muslim." Now, do you know if the Elections Commission has responded to this allegation?
No, the Electoral Commission has not responded to that allegation. But I think that allegation is a little far-fetched. The matter is sub judice, as we know. The issue that is before the courts is the falsification of electoral results through the usage of TIPEX, which is in dispute because obviously any document that has been altered in any way loses its credibility and does not suffice as an official document. And that is the crunch of the matter.
The former vice president had said to the chair lady of the Election Commission or threatened that if the chair did not respond to his allegation, he was going to publish or release this letter. If this is true now, can it be considered blackmail?
Well, no. I think he's playing hardball. He's trying to raise the stakes, if you like. And obviously, if the chair of the Electoral Commission resigns, it will be a tacit admission of guilt. So it is basically what you may call a hardball game.
So, you know, Mr. Chekwera and his Malawi Congress Party has gone to court about this election. Any idea when the court will rule?
It's not just the MCP that has gone to court. The UTM, which is headed by the former vice president, has joined the court case. So they're joint plaintiffs in this court case. As to when the court will rule, I think only God and the court knows when they're going to rule. Nobody can predict that.
Thank you very much, as usual, for speaking with us again.
You're most welcome, and stay well.
Rafik Hajat is Executive Director of the Institute for Policy Interaction in Malawi. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lilongwe. The United States has named a new special envoy for Sudan to lead diplomatic efforts to resolve the country's political crisis following the overthrow of President Omar al-Bashir. The State Department announced Wednesday that it had appointed Donald Booth, who served as U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan and South Sudan in President Barack Obama's administration, to be the special envoy again. Meanwhile, and as Naba Muhideen reports from Khartoum, negotiations on an interim government are set to resume between Sudan's protest leaders and the ruling Transitional Military Council.
The talks between Sudan's protest leaders and the Transitional Military Council are expected to resume this week, following concessions on both sides. Protest groups have suspended a nationwide strike called after security forces last week violently broke up a protest camp, killing dozens. The TMC, meanwhile, agreed to release political prisoners as a confidence-building gesture. The top U.S. diplomat in Africa, Tai Bernagi, who arrived in Khartoum Wednesday, have already met the opposition leaders. Yusuf Al-Jalal, a member of the Sudanese Professionals Association, the chief organizer of the protest, said Najib's presence may help the talks. He said the visit of the U.S. Deputy Foreign Minister to Khartoum may put the points of views of the TMC and the protesters' alliance closer, especially since the protesters have suspended the civil disobedience and the TMC has released the political detainees. But which side, civilian or the military, will have a majority in a new transitional ruling council until elections in 2022 is still in dispute. The protesters want to see a civilian-led government to replace the government of long-time President Omar al-Bashir, whom the military removed from power this past April after 30 years in power. Protest leaders and the TMC agreed on forming a joint military-civilian government, but talks were suspended when the two sides couldn't agree on who would hold the majority of the seats. Last Monday, security forces opened fire on the site outside the defense ministry, where demonstrators have been camped for nearly 2 months. Doctors aligned with the opposition say more than 100 people were killed. The health ministry puts the death toll at 61. Political analyst Mohamed Makawi says renewed talks can put an end to the tensions. Regarding the resumption of the talks, the politically shocking atmosphere shall be relieved if the two parties have the political willingness. It will put an end to the political polarization too, he says. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed met with protest and military leaders last Friday. One of Abiy's representatives has emphasized that if talks resume, they will pick up from where they left off, and a final government will be announced soon. Naba Muhideen for VOA News, Khartoum.
Uganda's health ministry has reported two more cases of Ebola, both involving family members of the Congolese boy who traveled from Congo on Sunday and entered Uganda to seek medical care. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization announced Wednesday that it will reconvene its emergency committee on June 14. WHO Acting Regional Emergency Director Dr. Zebilon Yoti spoke to Ricky Stryak about the early detection of the case and the preparedness of Ugandan health authorities.
When they crossed the border, the child was already having fever, and they went straight to a hospital, which is a missionary hospital, Kagando Hospital, which is in Uganda, and a missionary hospital. So immediately this child was identified because he was not feeling well, had come from DRC, high temperature, and then later the history of vomiting and having diarrhea and so on. With this, they just suspected this could be Ebola. That was really, Ricky, this was the best thing that can happen, that somebody arrives and then they detect immediately.
When a disease like this crosses a border, does it classify it in a new category of pandemic or epidemic?
What has been happening is the countries which are surrounding the DRC outbreak have been for the last 10 months in a preparedness mode. I mean, we have been working with them to make sure that they have capacities to detect and they respond, and in any case to quickly really put things in a place. And Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, and South Sudan, those which are very close, have been the four countries where we have really worked over these months to prepare them. So partners contributed a lot to this preparedness, as we are speaking now, there are preparedness activities going on in these places.
And I see that there have been two more cases of Ebola in Uganda already since the 5-year-old boy. So are those two new cases known contacts of the 5-year-old boy?
These four were listed by the Ugandan side experts as contacts already, as it would be. Contacts need to be monitored every day, if anything, twice a day. They need to be followed for the maximum incubation period, which is 21 days. So these things kicked off immediately, again, thanks to the preparedness. So with this, yesterday, two of those people developed early symptoms of fever and having weakness. And then samples were taken from them, blood samples. And this morning we received the results of the two. The government received and transmitted this information to us. So two more tested positive. And unfortunately, I think also the child, we are verifying this. I think the boy who was the first case, died in the night.
That was Dr. Zebilon Yoti, the World Health Organization's acting regional emergency director. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Brazzaville. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 13th. Daybreak Africa time is now 16 minutes past the hour. Kenyans took to the streets of Nairobi yesterday, Wednesday, protesting a government project to build a coal power plant near the Lamu Archipelago, a popular tourist attraction area that includes UNESCO World Heritage Site and vibrant marine life. According to Omar El Mawi, one of the protesters, the coal project in Lamu is harmful to human beings. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the project, which was launched 6 years ago, has not been constructed following objections from environmentalists and civil society.
The streets of Nairobi yesterday, Wednesday, were marred with chants from protesters who are against the government project to have the coal project in Kenya that will cost the taxpayer at least $2 billion. Omar El Mawi, one of the activists, says the move is to have the government stop the project for the good of the people.
If we move into coal, then it's going to affect our position, our strategic position, because, you know, a coal plant, the way that the economics are planned, is that you have to utilize the coal plant before you go into renewables. Therefore, we are going to be wasting a lot of our renewables and spilling it. We're also going to the Chinese embassy to read a statement that's going to encourage them to stop or withdraw from investing in coal projects, be it mines or plants.
In its report released this week, the U.S.-based Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis warned that due to a series of miscalculations, electricity from the coal plant will cost consumers 10 times more than estimated. In a letter to Kenya's Energy Cabinet Secretary Charles Keter, the protesters said the project threatens the livelihood of residents in the area. One of the activists representing Greenpeace organization who read the letter says the project will cause more harm than good.
As a community of stakeholders in Kenya, we would like to bring to your attention that these coal projects threaten the livelihood of citizens of Lamu County and the surrounding areas that depend on Indian Ocean and other resources for their basic needs.
The National Environmental Tribunal is set to rule on June 24th on the fate of the project that will see Kenya pay $360 million annually to the Chinese government, even if the power is not generated. The U.S. report titled Wrong Choice for Kenya says that 981 megawatts facility would be a costly error for the country. The Kenyan government views the project as a way to spur economic growth, create jobs, as well as ensuring Kenya's energy supply in the future. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
In the Gambia, the government of President Adama Barrow on Wednesday decided to take over all assets, companies and finances associated with the exiled former leader Yahya Jammeh. The government has also launched an appeal to the international community to help recover stolen assets by Jammeh and heading overseas. Pandero Mbaye reports.
Justice Minister Abubakar Tambedu on Wednesday addressed a news conference in Banjul, where he announced the government's decision to forfeit Jammeh's assets.
The president has approved and the government has taken the following interim measures as part of its recovery efforts against former President Yahya Jammeh. One, the immediate forfeiture to the state of all companies and their respective assets belonging to former President Jammeh upon the expiration on 17 June 2019. The freezing order of the High Court.
The government's decision followed a commission of inquiry that was set up to probe into the financial activities of Dictator Jammeh and his government. The Jammeh Commission has cited Jammeh for stealing over $1 billion, which is equivalent to $300 million. Jammeh was also linked to illegal land grabbing, among others.
Two, the immediate forfeiture to the state of all movable and immovable assets, including developed and undeveloped landed properties, chattels, shares, and other acquisitions by former President Yahya Jammeh.
Tambedu says the government has set up an interministerial task force that will investigate land stolen by Jammeh belonging to private Gambian citizens. Landowners who are victims of Jammeh's land grabbing have been asked to meet with the government task force. Justice Minister Tambedu has launched an appeal to the international community to help the Gambia recover assets stolen by Jammeh and are believed to be hidden overseas.
I once again take this opportunity to call on the international community, particularly our friends and allies in the United States, the United Kingdom, the European Union, the Africa region, and the Middle East, with expertise and experience in asset recovery, to assist the Gambia track and recover stolen assets belonging to the state.
The government has also seized all assets belonging to Mohamed Bassi, a Lebanese businessman. In another development, Justice Minister Tambedu says his ministry has decided to drop criminal charges against Yankuba Toure and Fatoumata Diakhoumpa Cissé. Toure and Cissé have been accused of tampering with a TRRC witness. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pahande Rimbaye reporting.
Rwanda's parliament has passed a draft law banning the manufacture, importation, use and sale of single-use plastic items in Rwanda. Eugene Uwimana has details.
From now on, plastic products such as bags, cups, straws, coffee stirrers, soda and water bottles, and most food packaging materials will no longer be acceptable in Rwanda. The draft law orders manufacturing industries to make the necessary changes by 2021. But the new law has been controversial among entrepreneurs. This law highly challenges us because apparently all industries are going to shut down their business and it will undoubtedly affect the whole society. You couldn't vote for it without considering our investments. You should attentively scrutinize these things without rushing on buying plastics just for the sake of doing it. It's not fair that someone sits in office and say, let's ban plastics. Some members of parliament have expressed similar concerns. There are many persons here in Rwanda who have started plastic manufacturing business to gain profit. And this law gives them only 2 years. Some work even under loans. Have you realized that they are going to fall in a very bad loss trap? Single-use plastics are plastics that are used only once before they are thrown away or recycled, which pollutes the environment at a very fast rate. For Vensabi Luta, Rwanda's environment minister, the new law is a good one and for the good of the public. Those 2 years are not given for businessmen to pay loans nor get their profit. 2 years is their time to change and be abide by the law. We are doing this for the future generation. This law that bans every plastic product follows a directive that banned only plastic bags 10 years ago. By now, many Rwandans claim insufficient packaging alternatives. According to the UN statistics, every year 80 million tons of plastics end up in oceans, which highly pollute the environment. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria, with a special FIFA Women's World Cup report. And good Thursday morning to you, Samson.
Good morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the latest update from the 2019 FIFA Women's World Cup taking place in France. Nigeria's Super Falcons took their chances against the run of play on Wednesday to beat South Korea 2-0 for a rare success at the Women's World Cup to set themselves up to advance to the next stage of the tournament in France. A first half own goal at the Stade du Alps and a breakaway attack brilliantly finished by Asisat Oshoala ensured the African champion only earned their fourth win in 8 World Cup finals appearances and a chance to go to the second round for just a second time. Super Falcons forward Asisat Oshoala became the second Nigerian player to score in 2 different Women's World Cup tournaments and was awarded the Woman of the Match in the Nigeria team's 2-0 win over South Korea.
For me, I always say I'm never under pressure. I just go on the pitch, I do my job. I follow the game plan with the team. It's an 11 players game. It's not a lone spot, you know. So it's not all about me. It's about the team. If I start putting myself under pressure and then I start tampering with the responsibility of other players, you know. So no pressure. Just go on the pitch, enjoy the game and have fun and do the right thing.
The Nigeria women's coach Thomas Denaby praised his players for their solid display in their 2-0 win over South Korea in Grenoble.
If we can be that compact as a team that we were today, don't let them overplay us in the midfield and create these good through passings or penetration passes. And if we have a little bit of a luck, we could have scored the third one when Asisat was all alone. A little bit of bad touch, the last touch. So, yeah, we follow the match plan, and that is all that you really can get out of the players.
Staying with the Women's World Cup, one of Africa's 3 representatives at the 2019 FIFA Women's World Cup, South Africa's Banyana Banyana, are set for their make or mar encounter against China later tonight. South Africa need nothing less than a win if they want to progress past the group stages. Banyana Banyana coach Desiree Ellis is not only faced with the hardship of coming up with a strategy for the all-important clash, but she also has to make a sound decision on who to fill in as replacement for Nathando Velakazi, who was red carded against Spain on Saturday.
This is the World Cup, and where you still have a big chance of going to the next round. You don't just want to, you know, want to make changes for the sake of making them.
Some of the Banyana Banyana players are confident of a positive result against China.
We have so many players who can play so many positions in this team. We have to set our minds straight when it comes to that game, because I believe it's a matter of us staying focused.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of African news. In Malawi, former Vice President Saulos Chilima has accused Electoral Commission Chairperson Justice Jane Ansah of directly influencing the results of the May 21st election to re-elect President Peter Mutharika. On Wednesday, a letter written by Mr. Chilima calling for Justice Ansah's resignation was leaked to the media. The United States has named a special envoy for Sudan to lead diplomatic efforts to resolve the country's political crisis following the overthrow of President Omar al-Bashir. The State Department announced Wednesday that it had appointed Donald Booth, who served as U.S. special envoy for Sudan and South Sudan in President Barack Obama's administration, to be the special envoy. That is it for this Thursday, June 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beck, for reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Strike, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barty, Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.